Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. The fundamental question in this episode, I guess, is why do we eat? The act of eating food is on one level a simple, primal experience about consuming fuel to keep our species reproducing effectively. But of course, us humans, we're complex primates capable of higher brain function. So in order to encourage us to really love our food, evolution has given us an avalanche of different sensations that interact, creating multimodal sensory experiences. We don't just taste food. We're bombarded by a sensory meteor shower. Taste mixes with smell, which interacts with sight, sound, touch, thermoperception, mechanoperception, texture, and added to that, we're dragged kicking and screaming through a whole range of psychological experiences, emotions, memory, expectations, anticipations, desires, pain. All of that's overlaid with culinary abstractions like history, morality, guilt, hope, religion, but all initiated by those primary sensations of smell and taste. Now, you might think I'm laying on a bit thick, but tasting and smelling food are some of life's most important experiences. So, for people whose senses have been altered by illness, cooking and eating can become joyless, even isolating. It's something lots of people have experienced with COVID or other illnesses, or going through invasive treatments, and the effect can be profound for people's wider health and well-being. So, today we're exploring sensory cooking, techniques which can help people to start enjoying their food again. And I am absolutely delighted to be joined by author, cook, and food stylist Ryan Riley, co-founder of Life Kitchen, a not-for-profit cookery school for people whose taste has been affected by cancer or cancer treatment. Hello there, Ryan. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm very good. And that was such a great intro and such a great way of explaining food.
Ah, well, fantastic. But yeah, I think you're going to take it even further. So first of all, can you tell me a bit about yourself? What kickstarted your journey into food?
It was a completely unconventional route. Life Kitchen was born out of my mother's death. I was 18 when she was diagnosed with small cell lung cancer. I became her primary carer during that time. But at 20 years old, she passed away, and it kind of was this moment in my life when I had this chance to look back on her illness and think about what really had affected her.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That's real tough times, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And it was horrendous because, you know, there wasn't just the physical effects of the treatment. It was the loss of taste was a really big one for her, which sent me down a path of a career, which I'll tell you all about. But my biggest moment was understanding that she could lose her hair, she could lose her eyebrows, but actually losing her sense of taste from the treatment, a side effect quite common in chemotherapy and radiotherapy, really kind of brought her mood down, made her feel isolated, and kind of ruined the last 6 months of our time of making memories together. You know, we kind of all focus on going out to eat to make memories. You know, we go to the pub, we go to restaurants with our friends, we eat three times a day. So For my mother, that became a very depressing fact. And that kind of led me along this very strange path to where I am today. I was 24 when I decided I wanted to be in food. I basically fell into the food industry and I worked in a food stall at Camden Market. I actually owned a food stall at Camden Market. I had no experience in food. It was just one of those young kid things that I wanted to do with my best friend. And we opened a food stall there. And didn't make any money, but it was a fantastic learning experience on people, on food, and on culture. And that got me thinking that I wanted to be in the food world. And I ended up getting a job at Sainsbury's magazine as a food intern. And that just transformed everything for me. I had this moment where I was like, I love food now. I understand it. It made sense. Like, it just, you know, layering one thing on another to create something just felt like, and you know, natural to me. So I ended up working at that magazine and kind of building up my skills. And that kept bringing me back in my head to, I want to do something that to help people like my mother. I want to do a cookery class for cancer patients. Surely I can transfer my skills now into my knowledge of what had happened to her and combine the two together. And Life Kitchen was born one night from a drunken tweet that went viral.
And how does Life Kitchen work? What's the structure behind it?
So Life Kitchen is a free cookery class and recipes and resources for people who are living with cancer. And basically, it's all about teaming up the world's leading scientists using culinary knowledge and also the patient experience to kind of really create something luxurious, fun, joyful, but backed by evidence that can help people enjoy food again. So we launched 5 years ago in February. So we're nearly 5 years old from a tiny little free cookery initiative to where we are today. And Life Kitchen, we launched at Hugh Fenny Whittenstall's River Cottage. I did 2 cookery classes in one day with 5 different members of the press, camera crews, Daily Mail journalists, threw myself in at the deep end. And I launched my first ever cookery class with 20 cancer patients in the morning and 20 in the afternoon. And it was just absolutely amazing. We took some recipes that I'd co-developed with Professor Barry Smith from the University of London. He's a sensory scientist. He's very well known, extremely well respected, and a part of Life Kitchen from day one. And we basically looked at all of the science of how we taste, so sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami, and how we can enhance those and use our basic taste and smell and texture and sight and layering to kind of bring together a really incredible set of recipes that we could use as a starting point. And, you know, we're like 4 books in, loaded TV shows down, and thousands of cookery classes later.
That's absolutely amazing. So the basic principle behind it, so I'm kind of wondering... Because flavor as a sort of an overall concept is multimodal. There are lots of aspects to it. Do you try to fill in the gaps where taste or smell doesn't exist with sight and other things, or is it actually just throwing more and more flavor to try and conquer a slightly less receptive set of taste receptors and olfactory receptors?
It's absolutely a mixture of those two things. You know, we try to really push recipes to their very max in terms of flavor, but we often use umami as our key thing. When you have lots of umami-rich foods, it not only stimulates the umami receptor in your tongue, but it encourages the other receptors to work harder. So the more and more umami you get into a recipe, the more and more your salt receptor is going harder, your sour receptor. So you're getting more and more of a chance of tasting from something. So we tend to use umami everywhere we possibly can. And then we look at what people are scared of is salt and sourness. And they're actually the two, often the key to kind of boosting and enhancing a dish. Salt is demonized, always has been, but actually it's just a flavor enhancer. And it's also what brings out the flavor in so many other things, as you well know. And we try very much to balance and layer things. But also there's the key element here, and it's a controversial thing to say, is that the British public tend to not be the most engaged cooks all the time, you know? So people who are, you know, living very busy lives, they're often buying convenience or just making quick and simple dishes. And what we always say is if you've lost your sense of taste when you're making really simple dishes, you're never going to find the solution in those simple dishes. We have to step them up a little bit, introduce new elements, you know, go a little bit left field just to find the little thing that works for them. So it's often about really giving a food education alongside building a load of really great recipes and resources that everyone can do. And some of our recipes are only 4 or 5 ingredients. But we've had really incredible results, and I've been very privileged to work with people all over the world, especially when we wrote Taste and Flavour, our book for COVID taste loss. That became a global sensation. We racked 2.8 billion media hits worldwide on that book.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And that was all about, we had access to one of the world's first research papers because of my team. We're one of the ones that got the government to make it a symptom in the UK alongside all the rest of the amazing science team. So we just used the initial knowledge of that with the knowledge of Life Kitchen, and we've been able to sort of help people in the cancer space and in the COVID space over the last 2 years. And it's been really incredible because 99% of what we do is free as well.
Yeah. And interesting that you know, that you're doing courses with people, because as you said earlier on, one of the aspects that your mum got very upset by was the isolation concept. So bringing people together for classes on cookery and dealing with the problem at hand as well must be a sort of a double win.
It is. One of my guests once said to me, and this line will always stick with me, he said, the reason Life Kitchen works is because it's barely about cancer at all. Yeah. And I just thought that really summed up everything, because it is that. It's beautifully, we're in beautiful spaces. I mean, my first class was at River Cottage, my second was at Jamie Oliver, and my third was at Dalesford. I mean, I've always went high with the standards. And then we had a collaboration with Duck and Waffle in the City of London, where we hosted cookery classes 60 floors up in the sky. You know, Life Kitchen is a luxury brand at a free price point because I just always want, I always think back to my mother being on the sofa, feeling incredibly unwell. And if I said, let's go for to this cookery class in a community center, she'd say, oh, maybe I'm not really feeling it, not up to it. If I said, let's go to River Cottage, where Sue Perkins and I will co-host a cookery class together, we'll start with champagne and we'll finish the day with a bunch of wonderful people trying new dishes, I think that's a bit more of a ploy to get you out the house.
You've got a very, very good point there. Yeah, absolutely. So the people that come to your courses, what are they, do they know what they're looking for? Do they know what's going to happen? And what sort of people are they? Is it just...
It's extremely varied, but they never know what they're coming into. So often, I always remember in the northeast of England, where I'm from, in Newcastle, there was a man who came to my class and he was 76-year-old called Mike Richards. He said, I'm only here because my wife has made me. She's given up. She's giving him, I don't want to be here. And I thought, well, this is a great start. And basically he said, my wife's got no idea what to do anymore. So we're here as a last resort, which again, piles on the pressure all of a sudden. And then we just basically worked with him on this first dish that we always do called pineapple tacos. And he cried and he said, that's the first thing I've tasted in a year. And the relief of his face and his wife's face and on their relationship was such an impact. And so, you know, people always, they kind of hear a cookery class for cancer patients. And, you know, you put it on that line. And I don't know if I would go to that if I had cancer. It doesn't sound that fun. But, you know, if you break down, when people kind of break it down what we are and the places we do it at and the environment we create and the very fact that people with cancer never really meet each other. They go to hospital, they sit chemo chair to chemo chair or hospital appointment to hospital appointment. They never really talk or interact. It's all a very lonely, personal journey with you and your friends and your family. Then very suddenly, they're at a beautiful cookery school, having a glass of champagne if they want, about to start the first dish, and someone says, so, well, I've got this cancer. And someone says, well, actually, I've got that cancer, or this has happened to me, or this is my experience. And that becomes an incredible opportunity for them to open up at their own pace. So I always say Life Kitchen's a bit like therapy as well for a lot of them, because they sit down, they share experiences at their own pace. And they do it while feeling under no pressure to kind of answer anything or be asked anything. And I think that creates a wonderful environment because they're not only sharing and making new friends, they're getting amazing food, they're trying new things, they're learning. And quite often learning is a key to it. When people get cancer, they often feel like their life is over. They haven't got much left. You know, they're surviving. But actually, if you tell someone, they're coming here to learn today, they feel like, well, I still have a life to live. I'm learning something new and I'm still privileged to have the opportunities to engage in new things. And Life Kitchen's become this like kind of way more important than me and a cookery class. It's all about the guests. And we've had an incredible opportunity to change a lot of people's lives, which is an incredibly crazy thing to say from one drunk tweet 5 years ago.
So from your experience in this, I mean, can you give us a little bit more insight into what people say that the emotional impact is of losing your certain sort of senses, like I presume taste and smell?
Yeah, definitely taste and smell. For a lot of people, it becomes very, very difficult to leave the house because our whole society is set up around eating and drinking. It's where we meet our friends. It's where we meet our family. It's where we have meetings. It's where we catch up with people. And suddenly, if you can't taste something and you're around a table with three other people who can taste things, you're not connecting with them because everyone's simultaneously connecting with the food on their plate. They're connecting with the drink in their hand and they're connecting with each other. You take out the being able to enjoy the food or drink element and suddenly you're sitting there in your own space while the world is going on around you. And that can incredibly build up to this like real isolation. It can often build up to eating disorders. Alongside the cancer treatment itself, some of them are so horribly harsh. You know, where there's things with their head and neck or their mouth or saliva. So eating becomes scary. They have to chew a lot of times or they have to have everything with lots of liquids or a bit of spice can really throw off their body and then go into a coughing fit. The psychological impact on not being able to eat and drink is one that is not talked about enough. And a one where Life Kitchen is the success that it is because before us, not many people were talking about it on such a scale. And so many of our guests would come to the classes and be like, oh my God, it's not just me suffering from this. There are other people. Because if I'm being quite frank, surviving cancer and, you know, having your chemo is a really important thing. And you only think about that. You think, oh, I've lost my hair, but you don't think, oh, I've lost my taste. That's the most important side effect, you know? So it often gets swept to the side. So for us, it's really important that we give people this chance to reconnect, re-engage, and often get over the fear of eating.
Yeah, absolutely. And so do you have any surprise? I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is about just fantastic, great food, but you mentioned a few things already, salt and sour. Are there some surprising tricks and tips that are really useful?
Yeah, umami, umami, umami. I say it all the time. And it's honestly the key to everything. We often teach some really cool dishes in Life Kitchen, but then we say, we know you're going to go home and your life isn't going to be changed by this cooking class. You're going to cook the food that you've always been cooking. So how do we get this next bit into that? So we say, if you're making spaghetti bolognese, slip a teaspoon of miso in there. Boost that umami underneath. Won't change the flavor too much, but it'll add and it'll build. And the real key is synergistic umami. When you get two different types of umami that come together and they form a really strong umami bond, I call it super umami in our classes because it's a lot easier to understand. but there's so many examples across food culture across the world. So ham and cheese, why is it one of the most famous sandwiches on the planet? Why is it delicious? Because they're two different types of umami that come together and form this synergistic umami. And that creates that real powerful savouriness that pushes the other taste receptors. It also stimulates saliva production because umami does. It makes it mouthwatering, delicious, exciting. So we often tell people that they've already been eating like they should, you know, chips and ketchup, two of the most delicious things when put together because they form that synergistic umami bond. So my biggest tip to anyone is get as much umami into your dishes as possible and get different types. Pea and scallop, you know, the classic dishes across the world are naturally umami rich. And it's often the key to the secret and the key to really good food anyway. But if you push it as far as you can, you've got more of a chance of enjoying food.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that's mainly about taste. What about smell? Are there some smells which are really significant for people? And is there anything that you can help with along those lines?
Yeah, volatile molecules. Now that sounds like a really scientific word and not one that I knew until Professor Barry-Smith talked to me about it. You know, when you tear basil and it very suddenly you can smell it, the second you've torn into it, that's the volatile molecules from the smell of the basil really going into your olfactory system. And things like that and strawberry, vinegar, all of the things that have really powerful smells are really, really important to kind of get into your dishes as much as possible. But there's often the first challenge we always face in Life Kitchen is getting people into that first dish. So it's getting them over that psychological barrier. It's getting them to understand there's a new element here and we have to eat a little bit differently or learn a little bit differently and then interpret it into your normal life. So pineapple tacos, I talked about it earlier, but this is our first dish that we start every class with. And that is a pineapple. You take the top and the bottom off, you skin it, and then you slice the pineapple into very wafer-thin rounds, and that becomes the taco shell, pineapple tacos. So the pineapple itself has an enzyme called bromelain, which really stimulates your saliva production, makes your mouth feel clean. And then we fill that with prawns, coriander, chili, spring onion, and lime. So all of those beautiful fresh flavors, you've got acidity, you've got texture, such an important one. Everyone forgets about texture in food. And you put all of that together and you bite into it and it's immediately acidic, it's immediately fresh and powerful. Coriander's in there, apart from if you've got that genetic gene that makes it taste like soap, then we'll leave that out. And then you just put all of that together and that's often the one thing that clicks with a lot of our guests because suddenly the smell, this taste, even the sensation of their mouth watering, which is the chemical reaction of the enzyme, you know, that says to them, food, mouth-watering, they psychologically remember the Chinese they have that makes it taste like that, or, you know, when they're really excited about some food. So it's kind of all about breaking down the barriers. Everything is psychological, although it's just a little recipe, you know. I wouldn't say I'm a world-leading psychologist or anything. I would say we're using very simple science done well.
Yeah, absolutely. So how about the psychological aspects of all this? I mean, how important are things like food memory? You know, do you try and avoid people cooking the things that they know because then they'll sort of be hit in the face by the loss of the experience of it? And how do you use that? How do you wake up emotions sort of associated with memories?
Well, quite often we talk to our guests and we say, do not cook the things that you love normally during treatment. Because if that tastes different, makes them feel sick, anything like that, that food memory is going to stay with them for a long time. And a lasagna in 3 years might throw them back to their time during treatment.
Yeah.
So we give them kind of a bunch of our recipes. There's tons of it online. We obviously have books that you can buy, but like there are loads of recipes out there. So we say, here's a whole like pack of things that you can do. But Life Kitchen really focuses on trying to like bring the enjoyment back into food. We always say Life Kitchen's about people. Our tagline is helping everyone enjoy food again, because it is just as simple as that. And we try to do twists on classics, so it's not as familiar to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like we do a really beautiful Parmesan cod with salt and vinegar cucumber salad. And that's kind of a riff on fish and chips. So the cucumber's pickled in malt vinegar, just classic, standard, cheap as hell malt vinegar. And then the fish is covered in really umami-rich Parmesan and thyme, and you bake it, and it's done in 10 minutes, and it's simple, it's aesthetic as hell, and it's really, really tangy. And for a lot of people, they eat it, and it reminds them of fish and chips, but it isn't fish and chips. And there's just those sort of little psychological moments that we kind of push on through with our recipes that don't kind of intimidate. Because food can be elitist and intimidating without even trying.
Yeah.
Because that's the culture we live in.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we try to really step that back and just make food accessible, enjoyable, easy, but all with purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we both mentioned Barry Smith a few times. He's a friend of the podcast as well. And I agree, he's absolutely fantastic on so many areas. How specifically has he helped you develop your ideas?
From day one, I heard Barry on a BBC podcast just after I came up with the idea of Life Kitchen. And I tweeted this idea and it went viral. And basically, I was getting a lot of attention very quickly for something I knew nothing about. And that was terrifying. So I went and researched and thought, who can I get to help me? And I've just stumbled across Barry. And I thought, well, a sensory scientist is exactly who I need right now. So I called him up and I said, this is what I want to do. I've written these recipes. Can I send you them? And he looked at them and he went, you've instinctively already done this really well. And I take that from my time as a in the test kitchen of magazines. You get to learn a lot of food very quickly. And I said to Barry, well, look, we want to do this. Can you help? And we launched at River Cottage together with Barry and we developed all these recipes. And he's been part of Life Kitchen since day one, still is to this day. And we basically have worked on the research. We've done testing things with him. We've done focus groups. He's been along to many of the classes and done proper citizen science. It's been an incredible journey for me because Barry gives me the science. I translate that into ingredients and then I tell the guests into recipes. So science becomes recipes through a chain of people because the science is undeniably difficult if you're not in that world. But if you tell someone ham and cheese goes together for this reason, most people can understand that or get that as a concept. So he kind of helps me distill all of the science into what I need it to be.
Yeah, he's fantastic, isn't he? Now, you mentioned expanding your work to include people with COVID. How's that changed how you work? Is there a big difference in symptoms of COVID compared to cancer?
Yes, completely. And I was so naive to it in the beginning. It was my business partner and co-founder, Kimberly Duke, who came to me and said, let's do something for COVID. And at this point, I'd just released our first book. It was a number 4 bestseller on Amazon. It was doing really well. And I was like, well, we've done our piece. The pandemic's happening. I'm scared too. Let's not do something we don't know about. And Kim was like, look, we're de facto world experts in taste loss and cancer, like we must be able to do something. And I was like, okay, fine, well, you're right, we know what we're doing, kind of, let's do something. And then Barry sent me through the research paper and realizing that parosmia and anosmia was a thing, and that garlic, onions, roasted nuts, all the key nice things that make recipes brilliant, were triggers for people, especially with COVID. So we went into this idea of writing this book, having to scrap everything we know about culinary creation and recipe writing. So we couldn't use garlic, we couldn't use onions to create those powerful bases that we've been so used to in Life Kitchen recipes. So we could have obviously done that for people with COVID taste loss, without parosmia and anosmia, but I wanted to make sure if we were going to do something, it was a resource that could go out in an ever-changing landscape, We knew nothing about really COVID at the time. We didn't know where it was going to go. We didn't know how it was affecting people other than this initial research. So our safest bet was to write a bunch of recipes that kind of took away most of the known triggers for these things. So Kim and I went on this massive journey with Barry, Absent, Altered Eating, some of the biggest groups who are in this space. And we kind of wrote these recipes, then we sent them out to people who were living with COVID taste loss and parosmia and anosmia, and we asked them to trial them. And then we took their research back and kind of did a medium down the middle of what the feedback was for the recipes. We put them together in a free book. We got Sunderland Council, where my cookery school is based, to pay for it from their COVID relief fund. And we partnered with Odyssey, who's a Greek brand that I love, who were just really keen to help. And their products weren't like unusual. So it's like olive oils and roasted red peppers. You can get any brand, but they were just good to help us. And we got 5,000 copies of the book that we gave away, physical copies that we gave away for free. They went in 3 days. 5,000 copies, which is crazy. And then the online download has done 100,000 downloads globally, which makes my book one of the biggest books in the world in food, really, for such an unknown person. And we didn't make a penny because we never, ever would want to benefit off something like that. But what I was really, really shocked at it is how much it blew up across the world. I mean, I was on the front page of the Washington Post. I launched the book on CTV in Canada. You know, I've done like every TV show in Britain. And I was once syndicated across every local TV show in America, just for this little taste and flavor, but because no one had written a resource and we were the first to do so. And we never claim that it's a magic bullet. It's inspiration guide with the science and the culinary knowledge that we have. And it's been incredibly well received. And there's tons of tweets and emails and stuff out there to say how much it's helped people, which is wild. It's just still crazy. I'm always blown over by what's happened.
Yeah. Okay, you've written a few books now. So here's your moment for a plug. Choose a book and tell us about it.
Well, my main book, my first ever book, was called Life Kitchen, Recipes to Revive the Joy of Taste and Flavor, which says exactly what we do. I published that with Bloomsbury in 2020, 2 weeks before the pandemic, just what you want. Perfect time for a book to come out. But it was really amazing because that book has got, I think, 300 five-star reviews on Amazon. And people love it. It did really, really well. And it is the resource that I go back to all the time. It's the one I'm constantly going on and on about. I refer to it in my classes. We teach our sort of syllabus from that book. And it's a one that we know has changed loads of lives, which is really amazing. If you just read the Amazon reviews, people say that. And it's very humbling. So that is probably the only paid resource that we have ever put out. So that is 20 quid. You can buy that online in Waterstones, Tesco, that sort of thing. But Taste and Flavor, the one for COVID, it was free, is free. You can still download it as an online PDF all across the world. And then we did two Christmas books as well. Christmas was a very special time for my family. So I wanted to be able to translate what we'd written in Life Kitchen into a Life Kitchen Christmas, which is what it's called. And it was just a free recipe book of how to make your Christmas like more flavor-packed.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Okay, now we are a food industry podcast. We've got food manufacturers, especially the big companies. And for them, sensory science is a major part of their R&D. What do you think that they could learn from your experiences with atypical sensory functions?
I think that the way that food is made and created in the industry these days, I think it's a little bit tame. I think everything needs to be pushed a little bit further. And, you know, the British public are ready for new things. The food culture of Britain is different to what it was. I think we need to be pushing more exciting flavours. We need to be adding miso to everything. Not in the typical, oh, let's do a miso caramel way. But like, I think we just need to be pushing those flavours a little bit more, seeing more exciting things out there. And I'm working on some stuff at the moment to do that as well for Life Kitchen. We constantly get asked, should we do a veg box, a recipe box, a meal kit? And I would like to do those things, but those things can become expensive and cancer is already an expensive time. So what we're always trying to do is create flavor hacks and little ways to kind of help people on a budget. Because when my mother was ill, my dad lost his job because of so many hospital appointments and we struggled for money. So that's why Life Kitchen is free at the point of use. And I think there's a really important element of that. you know, in everything we do. So I think food manufacturers especially could push flavor a little bit harder.
Excellent. Okay. So, and just lastly, what's next? You've done a whole series of different things. You've just mentioned a couple of exciting ideas of food boxes and recipe boxes and things like that. What is next?
Well, I'm currently in Manchester today. I'm on set for my brand new book with Bloomsbury again. It's the follow-up to Life Kitchen. I'm really excited. I've been writing this book since 2020. So it's a long time coming. This comes out, I'm not entirely sure when, 2023 or 4, hopefully 23. But the global paper chains and stuff at the moment are really messed up. So yeah, things are taking a lot longer.
Containers stuck everywhere.
Yeah, basically. So I'm looking forward to that. We've got loads of... I'm going on tour next year. So we're teaming up with some of the leading cancer charities in the UK. And I'm going to bring Life Kitchen back out into the spaces that it was born. So back out into the cities and towns. Cost of living is taking over everything. I don't want people to have to pay to come to us, so we're going to come to them.
Is that food festivals and things like that?
Yeah, food festivals always. I always do Taste of London, always do the big festival in the Cotswolds. Really nice, cool things. Hopefully loads more of that. But my biggest project right now, which I'm desperately trying to find the funding for, is a cost of living cookbook. So I want to do the follow-up to Taste and Flavour, but for cost of living. And figure out how to hack recipes for cancer patients that are super cheap, but do not compromise on flavor. Because 55% of people living with cancer this Christmas are choosing between heating and food, which is a terrifying statistic that no one should have to face. And I feel a very moral responsibility from the position that I'm in, the success and the crazy life that I've got now, you know, and I do have that. It's ridiculous, the life I have now, all because I did something cool and nice for people. So I want to make sure that I can continue on our legacy of really good free resources that are of extremely good quality but that are tried, tested, and that deliver really amazing results for very, very little impact on their side.
Yeah, and I can imagine that your mum would think it's an amazing legacy as well. She'd be immensely proud of you.
Thank you very much. That means the world. And it's something that I refer back to on every single project that I do. Is this why we started it? Is this, you know, where we're going to be heading? And the thing is, you know, there's always a commercial aspect of trying to survive as a non-profit in this world. So there are more and more things that we will have to do, I think, in the next year or two, looking towards the commercial slant. But that's only to ensure that we survive doing what the core part of Life Kitchen is about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, good luck with it all. I'm sure you'll do fantastically well, and I'm sure the new book's going to be an absolute storm as well. Ryan Riley, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. And remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe on your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, we'd be delighted if you could leave us a review. Thank you so much for listening.